For the past couple of years or so, maybe even two or three more than that, as we've been emphasizing our Bible reading and daily Bible reading and encouraging that, and I know there are a number who are following the same chart, the chronological Bible reading chart. I have different ones on occasion ask me questions about something they've read, something that is in a text involving maybe some kind of incident that we read about. Seems like most of these questions come from the Old Testament, maybe a person or something that is done. And I've been asked many good questions over the past few years regarding a number of things that we've been reading together in our Bible study. And so I announced just a few weeks ago, but I thought what I would try to do is to begin looking at some of those questions in a lesson periodically. So we're going to try to do that tonight. I want us to look at three or four questions, very good questions, that have been posed regarding some things from the first five books of the Old Testament. Really, these questions are all going to come out of either Genesis or Exodus. I hope that doesn't mean that's as far as we've read thus far, and I'm sure that it doesn't. But I've really enjoyed getting these questions and trying to work on them and work on some answers to these questions. And one of the things I want us to do, in fact, two or three things I want us to do is this. I not only want us to address the question and look at it from just, a study standpoint, an academic standpoint, I guess we could say. But I want us to also take just a few moments to look at the background, to look at the context, to look at the setting and remind ourselves of what is going on as the situation is unfolding, whatever might the circumstances be. And then as we look at these different circumstances, again, three or four this evening, I want us to see if we can draw some practical lessons out of what is taking place in each one of these instances. And so if you would, go ahead and be turning to Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9. The first question we're going to be dealing with this evening is not really, I don't think, an unfamiliar. I know it's not an unfamiliar account to us, but it's not the most familiar aspect of the account of Noah. Noah's life, of course, is recorded for us in Genesis chapters 6 through 9. And the vast majority of that centers around the flood and God's destruction of the world, which had become so evil by this great universal worldwide flood that wiped humanity off of the face of the earth except for Noah and his family. And so that's the context that we find in Genesis chapter 6 through 9. Man has become so sinful that God has determined that he's going to wipe the earth clean. As I understand the reading of the words there in chapter 6, there's going to be a 120-year period that God is going to exercise his long-suffering, that Noah is basically going to have to be building this ark, that he's going to be a preacher of righteousness, and then God is going to bring the destruction of the flood upon the entire world, upon the entire earth. And so, and let me just interject this, and I've made a few notes regarding this. The last couple of weeks, I think maybe this particular question has become even a little bit more timely because of the notoriety and I guess the popularity, the controversy surrounding the current film that is entitled Noah. And we might just make a few comments about that. It's a movie, and we've perhaps all seen the previews or heard what has been said about it by the studio itself that talks about this movie, Noah, and in essence proclaims it to be true to the essence, values, and integrity of the story. Now, if a story or a movie is being produced and you hear that it's going to be true to the essence and values and integrity of the story, you would have a right to expect it to pretty closely follow the storyline, wouldn't you? But here's what happens. And it doesn't take a whole lot of reading and research. It's not difficult to find material. I haven't seen the movie. I don't have any plans to, and I wouldn't necessarily encourage you to do that either because it's not true at all. In fact, from all that we read and see about this particular movie, it blasphemes God, and it slanders Noah, and it stands biblical morality on its head. So let me just say a word or two about that before we get to our question here in Genesis chapter 9. And by the way, I haven't even told you what the first question is yet, have I? The first question has to do with Noah becoming drunk, becoming uncovered, the actions there of Ham, and then the actions of Shem and Japheth, and then Noah's curse upon Canaan. It's going to surround that in those circumstances there. And so it has to do with not the brightest part of Noah's life, not the brightest part of Noah's history. But there are some things we can learn from that, and I think we can address that particular issue then. Well, let me just say a word or two more about the movie just for a moment. You may know this, but the movie was written and directed by a man whose name is Darren Aronofsky, who happens to be an atheist, and one who has very left-leaning geopolitical agenda. Now, not a very promising beginning for a Bible movie, is it, to be presented or to be produced or directed by an atheist? And throughout it, he has God pictured as being a hateful and vengeful, I should say, creator who brings destruction upon man for environmental reasons, not sin reasons. Well, I guess, but maybe he considers, this mythological attack that man has made on the environment back in Noah's days as being sin, perhaps. But he brings it upon mankind for environmental reasons, not for moral reasons, not for the reasons that we read about in Genesis chapter 6. And so throughout the movie, the blasphemy of God goes on, the speaking against God goes on as he presents God. And I understand the word, I've heard this, maybe you have too, that the word God itself doesn't appear in the movie. That the Creator is always addressed as the Creator. But that God created by a Big Bang. And then produced life through evolution. This is pictured there in the movie. And that God is seen as a cruel and vicious being who wants Noah basically to finish off the population of the earth. Well, obviously, just the opposite is true. Everything that God created was good. And God placed man in the best possible circumstances. Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3. It was man's sin that severed his fellowship with God. And even in the days of Noah, God is spoken of as being long-suffering. 2 Peter chapter 1 and there verse 20. Noah, I understand, is pictured as being kind of a cruel, callous individual with murderous intent who is obsessed with the obliteration of humanity. One quote I heard from the Noah character is that he was discussing why he had been chosen to be the builder of the ark, to have that role there. And he says, in essence, the Creator didn't choose me because I was righteous, but because he knew I would get the job done. Well, that goes against what we know about the character of Noah, doesn't it? He was a righteous man. He was a just man. In fact, he's described as one who stands out in contrast to the world and the sinful and degraded state that it found itself in because of sin. Over and over again, Noah is described as a good man and a righteous man. And far from being someone who seemed bent on destroying humanity, Noah is a preacher of righteousness. I think we can see in that Noah was trying to bring people around. He was trying to turn people. He didn't want to see people be lost. He's described as a preacher of righteousness in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5. And in fact, you might remember the text in Ezekiel chapter 14, where in both 14 and 20, verse 14 and also verse 20, there Noah is listed with Daniel and Job as three righteous individuals. God says, he talks about them in that context there. And he lists together Daniel and Noah and Job as being three very righteous individuals. And as we said before, it subverts the biblical morality, but sadly none of that is really a surprise to us, is it? As we think about the way that Hollywood and the movies and television treat the Bible and Bible characters and Christianity. It makes me wonder, and this is really an aside here, but can you imagine how the Muslims would react if Islam had been in their minds so mischaracterized as is the Bible and Christianity? More we could say about that, perhaps. Let's turn to the ninth chapter, and there verses 16, beginning in verse 18, rather, chapter 9, verse 18, and really reading through the end of the chapter. What is the situation here? What has Ham done? Why does Noah pronounce this curse upon Canaan? Beginning here in verse 18, and I want to interject one more thing before we start reading these verses here. We see Noah such a good man, a righteous character, a just man. Again, here we see Noah, and he glances into sin. He does something that's wrong. And one of the things I think that brings out just the inspiration of the Scriptures is that it presents the flaws, the warts, so to speak, of the characters in the Bible, as well as the good things, the righteous deeds that they do, whether it be David or Peter or here Noah. And we ought to be able to learn from that and even be encouraged by that and see how these individuals changed, how these individuals went on and did what was right. There's a second thing that we see in this, and that's the danger of drink, the danger of alcohol. And that's what brings Noah to this particular state here. It says, and the sons of Noah went forth of the ark, and the sons of Noah that went forth of the ark were Shem and Ham and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. And we'll see the reason for that explanatory note here just in a few moments. These are the three sons of Noah. Of them was the whole earth overspread. And Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and was drunken. And he was uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his two brethren without. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, and laid it upon both their shoulders, and went backward, and covered the nakedness of their father. And their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine, and he knew what his younger son had done unto him. And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, blessed be the Lord of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant, and God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tent of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. And then it describes Noah as living after the flood 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. And so here's the situation here, as we can picture. Noah becomes drunk, and he's found by his son Ham in this disgraceful, naked state. He is, in essence, in a situation where he is, you know, a spectacle, an embarrassment to anyone who would see him. In his right mind, in his sober mind, Noah would not be seen and would not be found in the condition that he is there. Now, that's what alcohol did to a good man. Well, Ham sees this situation here, and rather than treating Noah, his father, with some deference and respect and so on, and covering his father, let me just interject this. Nakedness was something that was much more condemned in those days, and people thought much more about that sin than people do today. And that's pretty obvious by the way folks walk around, isn't it? But here's Ham. And rather than treating his father with deference and reverence, he apparently looks on it with some glee. Oh, look at that. He got drunk. And look at this state he's in here right now. I'm going to go tell my brothers about that. He sees that particular state there. He apparently takes some kind of glee in it, and he goes out and he tells us, what do they do? They do the right thing. They don't want to see their father's nakedness. They walk in backwards. They have this garment, what is it described as going back here? A garment. And they walk backwards. And they've got it on their shoulders. And they cover him up without ever seeing. They do the right thing. They treat their father in a respectful manner. And here he is in this undignified situation. And they try to rectify it at that point the best they can. Noah becomes aware of what his son Ham has done, of the levity with which he approached that situation, evidently of how he told his brothers about it rather than simply dealing with that matter. And then he pronounces this curse on Canaan. Now let me say this. Canaan is, of course, the younger son of Ham. And the curse that Noah pronounced on Canaan, I think we can take as simply being there a prophetic oracle, a prophetic statement. Canaan, or the people of Canaan, as they came along, they partook of the same kind of mindset that Ham himself had. They were sinful and they were sensual, they were, you know, of a depraved mindset, and they departed from God. But let me say this. The statement that Noah makes there did not determine the character of Canaan. Their character was determined by themselves. But it's a prophetic statement as to the punishment that God would bring upon the children of Ham, the descendants of Canaan. And of course that happened. when Joshua entered the land of Canaan with the Israelites, beginning there in about the first chapter of Judges. They go after the Canaanites. They defeat the Canaanites, and Canaanites become the servants of Shem, of the Israelites. There's more we could say about that, but and if you have another question about that, if there's something I say that's not clear, feel free to, you know, we'll talk about that some more. I'd be glad to. But let's look at a second question this evening. Now, this one comes from Genesis chapter 19. Genesis chapter 19, and it concerns Lot and his daughters there, the situation involving Lot, and a statement he makes that could be taken, if we don't understand the culture and we don't understand the language in and of that day, could almost look like it's contradicting itself. Let's look here in the statement that Lot makes in Genesis chapter 19 and verse 7, and its statements that are made in 12 and verse 14. Now, you recall the situation here. God has determined, it involves destruction again, doesn't it? God has determined he's going to destroy Sodom, and he's going to destroy Gomorrah because of their sin, because of homosexuality. And so in verse 7, the angels come to the door of Lot, and the house of Lot, and they're telling him what God is going to do. And these perverted, deviant inhabitants of the city surround the house, and they say, "Bring these men out that we may know them." And in verse 7, Lot says, "I pray you, brethren, do not so wickedly. Behold, now I have two daughters which have not known men. Let me, I pray you, bring them out unto you, and do ye what is good in your eyes. Only unto these men do nothing, for therefore came they under the shadow of my roof." And so here Lot speaks of his daughters, and we understand the language there, whom he says have not known men, have had no physical relationship. Yet later on in verse 12 and verse 14, Lot refers to his son-in-laws. Verse 12, and the conversation in that context is continuing, says, "And the men said unto Lot, Hast thou any here besides? Son-in-law and sons and thy daughters and whatsoever thou hast in the city, bring them out of this place." Going down to the last part of verse 14, it says, "But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law." Here's one place I think that has helped to go ahead and to check some other translations. Let me just refer to some. How can Lot speak of his daughters as having not known them, yet he has son-in-laws? On the other hand, let's look at a couple of other translations with that regard. The New English Translation records it in these words. Speaks of those men as those who were going to marry his daughters. The NIV speaks of them as those who were pledged to marry his daughters. The NASB, ESV, NRSV all speak up in terms as who were to marry his daughters. And I think the best explanation of this is found in the matter of Jewish marriage that would involve the betrothal and the marriage ceremony itself. The betrothal was something that would take place months, maybe years, before a couple began to live together as man and wife under the same roof. And we're helped there when we look at the words of Joseph in Matthew chapter 1. Let me read you just a couple of paragraphs. This is coming from some material in Philip Owen's book on the life of Christ, where he discusses the betrothal here. He says the betrothal is considered a part of the marriage transaction. In fact, it was the most binding part. It consisted of a number of things. First, each party would accept terms of the marriage before witnesses, probably asking God's blessings on the union that would take place some months, or would take place after some months, perhaps some years. Second, there would be an exchange of gifts. He refers to this as sealing the covenant and binding the families together. And then he says, moving on down, the betrothal ended when the wedding ceremony occurred, after which the couple would live together as husband and wife. When two people were betrothed, they were considered married, though they had neither begun to live together nor to have physical relations. And so that would seem to be the case here. They had been betrothed, but a wedding ceremony had not taken place. They were not living together. And I think that would be further confirmed by the fact that there are no children to that union there. And that enters into something that takes place later on, doesn't it? That we're not a part of our question tonight. And so there's the social order there. Let's turn over just for a moment to Matthew chapter 1. And we can see some language that is used here when the birth of Jesus is being announced to Joseph. It says here, "Now the birth of Jesus Christ is on this wise, as when his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, Before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Before they came together, she's found with child. But Joseph is spoken of in verse 19 is what? Her husband. They've been betrothed. That part of the marriage had already taken place. We sometimes, I think of the betrothal or betrothal in terms of like an engagement. But it's really not. Because it's much stronger. It was binding. Two people become engaged today, and if they decide they don't want to get married, it's not best. They just break that engagement. But they haven't broken a marriage contract. And so, verse 19, Joseph, her husband, being a just man, not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. To sever that relationship, a putting away would have to take place, even though they were not living together at that point as man and wife. Hope I've made that just a little bit clear. I want us to address one more thing here. And here's the more practical aspect of the particular situation, and that is this. Why is Lot in this situation here? Why is Lot in this situation where he's making this, to our minds, this repugnant offer to these perverted individuals who are outside of his house? I have two daughters and so on there. An exaggerated emphasis on hospitality, to say the least. Why is Lot in this situation where he's going to have to flee for his life? Here living in the midst of a place where not even 10 righteous people can be found, and it's filled with these deviants, these homosexuals. Why is Lot going to find himself in a situation where he's going to lose his wife? He's going to become a pillar of salt. Where he's going to later have this illicit relationship with his daughters. By the way, alcohol comes into that. Again, that's not a part of this question, but it does. What gets him to this point in life? Well, it's choices that he made earlier on. You go back to Genesis chapter 13, and the question is posed there by Abraham. Where do you want to live? Which way do you want to go? You know, Abraham was the older. Abraham was the one who had, Lot should have given some deference to it. Said, no, you choose Abraham. But Lot looks and he sees a well-watered plain. He is concerned primarily with physical and material things, and he winds up in this situation here. It emphasizes to us the importance of the choices that we make and the criteria upon which we base our choices. Let's ask you a couple of questions. On what criteria do you base your choice of who your friends are going to be? You know, what's your job going to be? What's your career is going to be? Where you're going to live? Where you're going to go to school? Who your lifelong companion, your husband or your wife is going to be? What kind of activities you're going to engage in? Let me just pose two or three questions that I think will help us along that line. We could ask ourselves the question, is this thing, this choice I'm making, will it build me up? Or will it weaken me spiritually? Is it going to help or hinder me in my service to God? What effect will it have on my wife, my children, my family? So much more we could say about that. We need to move on. Let's address the third question this evening. These last two questions are going to involve Moses. Let's go to Exodus chapter 4 quickly, if you would. Exodus chapter 4 and hear verse 24. The person who asked me this question isn't here tonight. I regret that. But it's a short section here that we read. Seems a little obscure, a little unusual, and I think we probably just kind of scratch our heads when we get done with it. You remember this particular text here. God has already commissioned Moses at the burning bush, Genesis 3. In Genesis chapters 3 and 4, God has answered Moses' objections as Moses offers one after another. Lord, I can't go. I can't be your spokesman so long. You know, I don't speak well. They won't believe me. Who should I say has sent me? And so on. And finally, God just says, you're going. It's going to be you. I'm going to send Aaron with you. But Moses kept, you know, battling so much that God becomes angry with Moses. But here then, as God tells Moses, now you can return back to Egypt. He'd been in Midian for 40 years after living in Egypt for 40 years. He's 80 years old. He says, those who sought to kill you, they're dead. And so let's begin reading. Let's back up to verse 18. It says, and Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said unto him, let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go and teach. And the Lord said unto Moses in Midian, Go, return into Egypt, for all the men are dead which sought thy life. That's an interesting expression there because of the question. The question is, what is this where God is seeking Moses' life? In the next few verses we're going to read. God says to Moses, now the people who are seeking your life, they're dead. And we're going to read just a few more words, and God is seeking Moses' life. What is that about? And so it says, and Moses took his wife and his sons, and set them upon an ass, and returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God in his hand. And verses 21 through 22 describe the Pharaoh is hardening his heart. God says, I'm going to slay, his firstborn, and so on. And then beginning in verse 24 and reading through 26, it says, And it came to pass, by the way, in the end, that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. And then Zipporah, Moses' wife, of course, took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet and said, Surely a bloody husband art thou to me. So he let him go. Then she said, A bloody husband art thou because of the circumcision there. What is that about? Why is God seeking to kill Moses? And how is it, how is it rectified by what Zipporah does here in performing this rite of circumcision? I've seen some puzzled looks. Has that never been a question? Has that question maybe never crossed your mind? Here I think is the explanation as far as what takes place here. And the first question perhaps that ought to come to our mind is this. Why does Moses have a son who has not been circumcised? You go back to Genesis chapter 17, and God's law, His commandment for the descendants of Abraham was, you circumcise your males on the eighth day. Why, he has a son who's old enough to be riding this animal here as they're going back to Egypt. And he clearly hasn't. Moses has transgressed God's law. He's failed to carry out one of God's positive commandments, and here we see God's reaction to that. You can go back and read the commandments there. You remember them in Genesis 17, there in verses 9 through 14. And yet here Moses is, and he's to be the leader of God's nation, and he hasn't carried out one of the most basic commandments that God has given for those people. Circumcision was given as a token of the land covenant that God made with Abraham and of Israel's relationship to God. How serious was it? God said, those who are not are to be cut off, are to be put to death there in Genesis chapter 17. That helps us to understand a little bit more about the seriousness of this situation. And so God's anger against Moses is evident in that, and I think we can understand this, in that he afflicts Moses with that which imperils his life. Moses' life is brought into danger here with something that God afflicts him with. Doesn't tell us exactly what it was, some kind of illness or whatever the malady is, but it is rectified only when, and perhaps this brings the question to mind, is he now so incapacitated that it's up to Zipporah to carry out and do what he should have done sometime in the past. Well, I think we see from her words there, she performs the rite, and then the actions that follow indicate her aversion, her revulsion to that act there. And perhaps this is something that Moses had allowed to hinder him from doing what God would have had him to do. You know, how tragic here, and perhaps there's a lesson we can get here. In deference, it would seem, perhaps to the poor and her revulsion of this particular rite here, Moses had failed to carry out one of God's commandments. Can we make some applications of that today? Can our family members somehow... Or sometimes maybe a husband, wife, grandmother, grandfather. We hear people say sometimes, well, if I just obey the gospel, it's going to be going against what I was taught by someone in my family. We see God's grace here. He gives Moses a chance to stay alive when the right thing is done. We see the seriousness of sin, and that as Moses is brought to a point of death, we see the importance of keeping God's commandments. More we could say about that, but perhaps that will help along that line. Let's take just a couple of moments and look at a fourth question this evening. And again, it deals with Moses, Exodus chapter 33 and verse 11. And the Ten Commandments have been given to Moses on Mount Sinai. Moses is coming back down the mount, has already come back down the mount with Joshua. And what do they hear? What do they see in chapter 32? Israel has already departed from God. They built this golden calf, and they're worshiping it, and they're having this festival around it, and it describes the things that are going on there. Moses is so incensed that he breaks the stones, he breaks the tablets. God is so angry that he says, I'm going to withdraw my presence from these people. I'm not going to be with them anymore. And in fact, Moses has this temporary tent outside of the camp, not in the camp, but outside of the camp where God meets with him and talks with him. And the people rise up and they're reverential, and Moses walks out there. The cloud is over the tent. Joshua is guarding this tent here, you remember? In the 33rd chapter, the question is this, and it's based on what's said in verse 11 and verse 20. How can it be said that God spoke to Moses face to face the way a person speaks to a friend when verse 20 tells us that one cannot see God's face and live? It's a good question, isn't it? And what it brings into question here, or the thing that it brings up here, is this. Let's read verse 11 and read verse 20. Verse 11 says, And the Lord spake unto Moses face to face as the man speaketh unto his friend. And then verse 20, it says, And he said, Thou cannot see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. Well, obviously, here we have some expressions, here we have some words that are being used in different ways in the same text. I think the import of God speaking to Moses face to face here, here in verse 11, doesn't mean somehow that Moses saw some kind of literal, sort of physical presence or manifestation of God. God is the Spirit, John 4 and verse 24. Jesus said, you know, Spirit doesn't have flesh and bones and so on, later on after his resurrection. What is being denoted here in verse 11 is the nature of the communication. God isn't using some kind of medium or some kind of intermediary to speak to Moses. It has to do with the closeness of the association, and not something that Moses is actually seeing, or someone, some kind of being that Moses is actually seeing there. It means that here's the emphasis. Moses is closely and directly talking with God as friends talk with one another. No mediator, no intermediary here. In fact, helpful there, I think, is Numbers chapter 12, verses 7 and 8, where they are said to be speaking mouth to mouth. We have a little bit more time. We talk about anthropomorphic language, where God is described in human terms as having a finger, as having a hand, as having an arm, as having a back, eyes, ears, and so on. But God is a spiritual being. But in Numbers chapter 12 here, beginning in verse 7, you remember Miriam and Aaron don't like the situation that God has with Moses as his spokesman here. And God speaks to them and says, My servant Moses is not so. Well, let me back up to verse 6. And he said, Hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision, and will speak to him in a dream. This is how God would communicate with just, you know, a regular prophet, so to speak, in a vision, in a dream. But he said, My servant Moses is not so, who's faithful in all mine house. He said, Moses and God had a closer relationship than God just had with a regular prophet, as we would say. He says, With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even apparently, not in dark speeches. And the similitude of the Lord shall he behold. Wherefore were ye then not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And you remember this had been occasioned really by the fact that they didn't like the marriage between Moses and this Ethiopian woman back in the first part of Numbers chapter 12. All right, then what about the question then in verse 20? He says, No man can see my face and live. Let's go back to verse 18 just for a minute. I think it's key here. In verse 18, here, Moses beseeches God for a favor. What is it? And he said, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. Now, had Moses already been having some kind of conversation where there's this physical presence or manifestation with the face of God, he wouldn't have made that request there, would he? He would have already seen the glory of God. That had to do with the nature of the conversation. Now he's saying in verse 18, show me thy glory. I want to see your essence. I want to see you as you really are. God's not going to grant that. In fact, what we read again is what's stated in verse 20. there shall no man that thou canst not see my face. For no man, there shall no man see me and live. And so this would be some kind of visible, actual manifestation of God, His divine essence, that Moses is asking for, to show me your majesty. God says, and we won't get into this, but He shows him, the afterglow, so to speak, of His majesty, His passing by, and what takes place there just a little later, there in verse 23. A couple of things here. It's interesting to me to think about Moses in this context here where he says, Lord, show me your glory. Show me your majesty. Later on the Mount of Transfiguration, there's Moses, and he sees the majesty of the Lord, doesn't he? That's why we read there from 2 Peter chapter 1. You may have been wondering, what does this have to do with 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16 through 21? Peter speaks on that occasion. He says, we were with him in the Holy Mount. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. It's interesting to me that Moses was chosen to be there and be one of those who was an eyewitness of his majesty. Just a couple more points, then we will stop our lesson tonight. John chapter 1 and verse 18. John chapter 1 and verse 18. The point is made there that no man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, He hath declared Him. Jesus Christ came to this earth, and He became the declaration, the manifestation of God the Father. John chapter 14, you remember, the request there is made, Lord, show us the Father, and it sufficeth us. That's Philip who says that in verse 8. Jesus said, I've been so long a time with you, Philip, and you have not known me. You have not seen me. One day, there will be those who will see the face of God. Let it be those who are saved, those who are in heaven with Him. And that's the point made in Revelation chapter 22 and verse 4. Revelation 22 and verse 4. And that's the point that we'll bring our study to a close this evening. Because we want to be there in heaven one day where we can see the face of God. We will see Him face to face. Revelation the 22nd chapter. And there verse 4. In this description of the nature of heaven, John says, and they shall see His face, and His name shall be in their forehead. And there shall be no night there, and they need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. That's after this life is over. That's in the next life. That's in heaven. That's granted to those who have eternal life. The lesson is yours this evening. Hope these things have been helpful. Look forward maybe to having another study along this line, dealing with some more questions that you present. One important question left for tonight, though, and that's this. Have you done what God teaches in order to be saved? Are you living the kind of life that He would have you to live in order to be counted faithful in His sight, so that when Jesus comes again, you can enjoy eternal glory with Him? If you're here tonight and have never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, being baptized as a penitent believer for the remission of your sins, or you're here and you've done that, but you've fallen away, you need to make your life right in His sight, won't you come as we stand and as we sing this evening?